The Irishman, Needle, the Rainy Boys held the herd. It was a beautiful morning, too. Mountains seemed closer. Newt wondered if Dietz knew about any of it. He didn't look at the corpse again, but he wondered if Dietz had kept on knowing somehow. He felt he did. He felt that if anyone was taking any notice of him, it was probably Dietz, who had always been his friend. It was only the thought that Dietz was still knowing him, somehow, that kept him from feeling totally alone. Even so, the Dietz who had walked around and smiled and been kind to him day after day through the years, that Dietz was dead. Newt sat on his blankets and cried until he was afraid he would never stop. No one seemed to notice. No one said anything to him as preparations for burying Dietz went on. P.I. didn't cry, but he was so shaken he went weak in the legs. "Well, my Lord," he said from time to time. "My Lord!" An Indian boy had killed him, the captain said. Dietz was still wearing a pair of the old patchy quilt pants that he had favored for so long. P.I. scarcely knew what to think. He and Dietz had been the main hired help on the Hat Creek outfit ever since there had been a Hat Creek outfit. Now it was down to him. It would mean a lot more chores for him, undoubtedly, for the captain only trusted the two of them with certain chores. He remembered that he and Dietz had a pretty good conversation once. He had been vaguely planning to have another one with him if the chance came along. Of course, that was off now. P.I. went over and leaned against a wagon wheel, wishing he could stop feeling weak in the legs. The other hands were somber. Soupy Jones and Bert Borum, who didn't feel it appropriate for white men to talk much to niggers, exchanged the view that, nevertheless, this one had been uncommonly decent. Needle Nelson offered to help dig the grave. For Dietz had been the man who finally turned the Texas bull the day the bull got after him. Dish Boget hadn't said much to Dietz either, but he had often been cheered, from his position on the point, to see Dietz come riding back through the heat waves. It meant he was on course, and the water was somewhere near. Dish wished he had said more to the man at some point. Lippy offered to help with the grave digging, and Call led him. It was the task that usually got assigned to Dietz himself, grave digging. Call had laid many a companero in graves Josh Dietz had dug, including, most recently, Jake's Boone. Lippy was not a good digger. In fact, he was mostly in the way, but Call tolerated him. Lippy also talked constantly, saying nothing. They were digging on a little rise north of the juncture where Salt Creek joined the Powder River. Augustus wrapped Dietz carefully in a piece of wagon sheet and tied the sheet around him with heavy cord. "A shroud for the journey," Augustus said. No one else said anything. They loaded Dietz in the wagon. Newt finally got out of his blanket, though he was almost blind from crying. Pocampo led the team down to the grave, and Dietz was put in and quickly covered. The Irishman, unasked, began to sing a song of mourning, so sad that all the cowboys at once began to cry, even the Spettle Boy, who had not shed a tear when his own brother was buried. Augustus turned and walked away. "I hate funerals," he said, "particularly this one. At the rate we're dropping off, there won't be many of us left by the time we get to Montana," Lippy said, as they were all walking back to camp. They expected to start the herd that day, as Captain Call had never been known to linger, but this time he did. He came back from the grave, got a big hammer, and knocked a board loose from the side of the wagon. He didn't explain what he was doing to anyone, and the look on his face discouraged anyone from asking. He took the board and carried it down to the grave. The rest of the day he sat alone by Dietz's grave, carving something into it with his knife. The sun flashed on his knife, and the cowhands watched in puzzlement. They just didn't know what it could be that would take the captain so long.
"He had a short name," Lippy observed.
It wasn't his full name, Newt pointed out. He had stopped crying, but felt empty. "What was the other then?" Jasper asked. "It was Josh." "Well, I swear," Jasper said. "That's a fine name. Starts with a J, like mine. We could have been calling him that all the time, if we'd known." Then they heard the sound of the hammer. It was the big hammer that they used for straightening the rims of the wagon wheels. Cap McCall was hammering the long board deep into the dirt by the grave. Augustus, who had sat by himself most of the day, walked over and squatted down by Newt, who sat a little way apart. He had been afraid he would start crying again and wanted a little privacy. "Let's go see what he wrote for old Dietz," Augustus said. "I've seen your father bury many a man, but I never saw him take this kind of pains." Newt hadn't really been listening. He had just been sitting there, feeling numb. When he heard Augustus mention his father, the words sank into the numbness for a minute and didn't affect him. Then they did. "My what?" Newt asked. "Your father," Augustus said. "Your pa." Newt thought it an odd time for Mr. Gus to make a joke. The captain wasn't his pa. Perhaps Mr. Gus had been so affected by Dietz's death that he had gone a little crazy. Newt stood up. He thought it best just to ignore the remark. He didn't want to embarrass Mr. Gus at such a time. The captain was still hammering, driving the long board into the hard ground. They walked down to the grave. Call had finished his hammering and stood resting. Two or three of the cowboys trailed back to the grave, a little tentative, not sure they were invited. Captain Call had carved the words deeply into the rough board so that the wind and sand wouldn't quickly rub them out. "Josh Dietz, served with me 30 years, fought in 21 engagements with the Comanche and Kiowa, cheerful in all weathers, never shirked a task, splendid behavior." The cowboys came down one by one and looked at it in silence. Pocampo crossed himself. Augustus took something out of his pocket. It was the medal the governor of Texas had given him for service on the border during the hard war years. Call had one, too. The medal had a green ribbon on it, but the color had mostly faded out. Augustus made a loop of the ribbon and put the loop over the grave board and tied it tightly. Captain Call had walked away to put up the hammer. Augustus followed. Lippy, who had not cried all day, suddenly began to sob, tears running into his loose lip.
"I do wish I'd just stayed in Lonesome Dove," he said when he stopped crying.
Chapter 91
They trailed the herd up the Powder River, whose water none of the cowboys liked. A few complained of stomach cramps, and others said the water affected their bowel movements. Jasper Fant, in particular, had taken to watching his own droppings closely. They were coming out almost white when any came out at all. It seemed an ominous sign.
"I've met ladies that wasn't as finicky as you, Jasper," Augustus said.
But he didn't bother to tease Jasper very hard. The whole camp was subdued by Dietz's death. They were not missing Dietz so much, most of them, as wondering what fate awaited them in the north. When they crossed the Powder, they could see the Bighorn Mountains looming to the west, not really close, but close enough that anyone could see the snow on top of them. The nights began to be cold, and many of the hands began to regret the fact that they had not bought better coats in Ogallala when they had the opportunity. The discussions around the campfire began to focus mainly on storms. Many of the hands had experienced plains northers and the occasional ice storm, but they were South Texas cowhands and had seldom seen snow. A few talked of loping over to the mountains to examine the snow at close range and see what it was like. Newt had always been interested in snow and looked at the mountains often. But in the weeks following Dietz's death, he found it difficult to care much about anything, even snow. He didn't pay much attention to the talk of storms. He didn't really care if they all froze. herd and hands together. Occasionally, the strange remark Mr. Gus had made came back to him. He didn't know what to make of it. The clear meaning had been that Captain Carl was his father. It didn't make sense to Newt. If the captain had been his father, surely he would have mentioned it at some point in the last 17 years. At other times, the question would have excited him, but under the circumstances, he felt too dull to care much. Set beside the fact that Dietz was gone, it didn't seem to matter greatly. Anyway, if Newt had wanted to question the captain about it, he would have had a hard time catching him. The captain took Dietz's job and spent his days rangering far ahead. Usually, he rode back to the herd about dark to guide them to a bed ground. Once during the day, he had come back in a high lope to report that he had crossed the tracks of about 40 Indians. The Indians had been heading northwest, the same direction that they were heading. For the next few days, everyone was tense, expecting Indian attack. Several of the men took alarm at the sight of what turned out to be sagebrush or low bushes. No one could sleep at night, and even those hands who were not on guard spent much of the night checking and rechecking their ammunition. The Irishman was afraid to sing on night duty for fear of leading the Indians straight to them. In fact, night herding became highly unpopular with everyone, and instead of gambling for money, men began to gamble over who took what watch. The midnight watch was the most unpopular. No one wanted to leave the campfire. The men who came in from the watches did so with profound relief, and the men who went out assumed they were going to their deaths. Some almost cried. Needle Nelson trembled so that he could barely get his foot in the stirrup. Jasper Fant sometimes even got off and walked when he was on the far side of the herd, reasoning that the Indians would be less likely to spot him if he was on foot. But a week passed and they saw no Indians. The men relaxed a little. Antelope became more common, and twice they saw small groups of buffalo. Once the remuda took fright in the night, and the next morning Call found the tracks of a cougar. The country began to change slightly for the better. The grass improved, and occasionally there were clumps of trees and bushes along the riverbed. It was still hot in the afternoon, but the mornings were crisp. Finally, Call decided to leave the Valley of the Powder. He felt the threat of drought was over. The grass was thick and wavy, and there were plenty of streams. Not long after leaving the Powder, they crossed Crazy Woman Creek. Every day it seemed that there was more snow on the mountains. Traveling became comparatively easy, and the cattle regained most of the flesh that they had lost on the hard drive. Almost daily, from then on, Call saw Indian signs. But no Indians. It bothered him a little. He had fought Indians long enough not to underrate them. But neither did he exaggerate their capacities. Talk of Indians was never accurate, in his view. It always made them seem worse or better than they were. He preferred to judge the northern Indians with his own eyes, but in this case the Indians didn't oblige him. "We're driving 3,000 cattle, Call said. They're bound to notice us.
They ain't expecting cattle, Augusta said. There's never been cattle here before. They're probably just out hunting, trying to lay in enough meat to last them the winter.
I guess we'll meet soon enough, Call said.
If not too soon, they may come biling out of them hills and wipe us out any day. Then they'd have enough meat to last the winter. They'd be rich Indians, and we'd be dead fools.
Fools for doing what? Call asked. This country's looking better all the time.
Fools for living the lives we've lived, Augusta said.
I've enjoyed mine, Call said. What was wrong with yours?
I should have married again. 2 wives ain't very many. Solomon beat me by several hundred. Although I got the same equipment he had, I could have managed 8 or 10 at least. I don't know why I stuck with this scraggly old crew.
Because you didn't have to work, I guess, Call said. You sat around and we worked.
I was working in my head, you see. I was trying to figure out life. If I had a couple more fat women to lay around with, I might have figured out the puzzle.
I never understood why you didn't stay in Tennessee if your family was so rich, Call said.
Well, it was tame, that's why. I didn't want to be a doctor or a lawyer. And there wasn't nothing else to do in those parts. I'd rather go outlaw than be a doctor or a lawyer.
The next day, as they were trailing along a little stream that branched off Crazy Woman Creek, Dish Bogart's horse suddenly threw up his head and bolted. Dish was surprised and embarrassed. It had been a peaceful morning, and he was half asleep when he discovered he was in a runaway, headed back for the wagon. He sawed on the reins with all his might, but the bit seemed to make no difference to the horse. The cattle began to turn, too, all except the Texas bull, who had let out a loud bellow. Call saw the runaway without seeing what caused it at first. He and Augustus were riding along together, discussing how far west they ought to go before angling north again. "Reckon that horse ate loco weed or what?" Call asked, spurring up to go help hold the cattle. He almost went over the mare's neck, for he leaned forward, expecting her to break into a lope, and the mare stopped dead. It was a shock, for she had been quite obedient lately and had tried no tricks.
"Call, look!" Augustus said.
There was a thicket of low trees along the creek, and a large, orangish-brown animal had just come out of the thicket. "My Lord, it's a grizzly," Call said. Augustus didn't have time to reply, for his horse suddenly began to buck. All the cowhands were having trouble with their mounts. The horses were turning and running as if they meant to run back to Texas. Augustus, riding a horse that hadn't bucked in several years, was almost thrown. Instead of fleeing, most of the cattle turned and looked at the bear. The Texas bull stood all by himself in front of the herd. Call drew his rifle and tried to urge the hell bitch a little closer, but had no luck. She moved, but she moved sideways, always keeping her eyes fixed on the bear, though it was a good 150 yards away. No matter how he spurred, the mare sidestepped, as if there were an invisible line on the prairie that she would not cross.
"Damnation, there goes the grub," Augustus said.
He had managed to subdue his mount. Call looked and saw that the mules were dashing off back toward the powder, Lippy sawing futilely at the reins and bouncing a foot off the wagon seat from time to time.
"Cap'n, it's a bear," Dish Bogart said.
He had managed to turn his horse in a wide circle, but he couldn't stop him, and he yelled the words as he raced past. There was confusion everywhere. The remuda was running south, carrying the Spittle Boy along with it. Two or three of the men had been thrown, and their mounts were fleeing south. The thrown cowhands, expecting to die any minute, though they had no idea what was attacking, crept around with their pistols drawn.
"I expect they'll start shooting one another right off," Augustus said. "They'll mistake one another for outlaws if they ain't stopped."
"Go stop 'em," Call said. He could do nothing except watch the bear and hold the mare more or less in place. So far, the bear had done nothing except stand on its hind legs and sniff the air. It was a very large bear, though. To Call, it looked larger than a buffalo.
"Hell, I don't care if they shoot at one another," Augustus said. "None of them can hit anything. I doubt we'll lose many."
He studied the bear for a time. The bear was not making any trouble, but he apparently had no intention of moving either.
"I doubt that bear's ever seen a brindled bull before. He's a mite surprised, and you can't blame him."
"Darn, that's a bit big bear," Call said.
"Yes, and he put the whole outfit to flight just by walking up out of the creek," Augustus said.
Indeed, the Hat Creek outfit was in disarray. The wagon and the remuda still fleeing south, half the hands thrown and the other half fighting their horses. The cattle hadn't run yet, but they were nervous. Newt had been thrown sky-high off the sorrel Clara had given him and had landed painfully on his tailbone. He started to limp back to the wagon, only to discover that the wagon was gone. All that was left of it was Pocampo, who looked puzzled. He was too short to see over the cattle and had no idea there was a bear around. "Is it Indians?" Newt asked. He had not yet seen the bear, either. "I don't know what it is," Pocampo said. "But it's something mules don't like." Only the two pigs were relatively undisturbed. A sack of potatoes had bounced out of the fleeing wagon, and the pigs were calmly eating them, grunting now and then with satisfaction. The Texas bull was the only animal directly facing the bear. The bull let out a challenging bellow and began to paw the earth. He took a few steps forward and pawed the earth again, throwing clouds of dust above his back.
"You don't think that little bull is fool enough to charge that bear, do you? Charging Needle Nelson is one thing. That bear'll turn him wrong side out."
"Well, if you want to go rope that bull and lead him to the barn, help yourself," Carl said. "I can't do nothing with this horse." The bull trotted forward another few steps and stopped again. He was no more than 30 or 40 yards from the bear. The bear dropped on all fours, watching the bull. He growled a rough, throaty growl that caused 100 or so cattle to scatter and run back a short distance. They stopped again to watch. The bull bellowed and slung a string of slobber over his back. He was hot and angry. He pawed the earth again, then lowered his head and charged the bear. To the amazement of all who saw it, the bear batted the Texas bull aside. He rose on his hind legs again, dealt the bull a swipe with his forepaw, and knocked the bull off his feet. The bull was up in a second and charging the bear again. This time it seemed the bear almost skinned him. He hit the bull on the shoulder and ripped a cape-like piece of skin loose on his back. But despite that, the bull managed to drive into the bear and thrust a horn into his flank. The bear roared and dug his teeth into the bull's neck. But the bull was still moving, and soon the bear and the bull were rolling over and over in the dust. The bull's bellows and the bear's roar so loud that the cattle did panic and begin to run. The hell bitch danced backward, and Augustus's horse began to pitch again and threw him. Though Augustus held the rein and managed to get his rifle out of the scabbard before the horse broke free and fled. Then Call found himself thrown too. The hell bitch, cat-like, simply doubled out from under him. It came at an inopportune moment, too, for the bull and the bear, twisting like cats, had left the creek bank and were moving in the direction of the herd. Although the dust the battle raised was so thick that no one could see who had the advantage, it seemed to Call that when he looked, that the bull was being ripped to pieces by the bear's teeth and claws. But at least once the bull knocked the bear backward and got a horn into him again.
"Reckon we ought to shoot," Augustus said. "Hell, this outfit'll run clean back to the Red River if this keeps up."
"If you shoot, you might hit the bull," Call said. "Then we'd have to fight the bear ourselves. And I ain't sure we can stop him. That's a pretty mad bear." Pocampo came up holding a shotgun. Newt a few steps behind him. Most of the men had been thrown and were watching the battle tensely, clutching their guns. The sounds the two animals made were so frightening that they made the men want to run. Jasper Fant wanted badly to run. He just didn't want to run alone. Now and then he would see the bear's head, teeth bared, or his great claws slashing. Now and then he would see the bull seem to turn to bunched muscle as he tried to force the bear backward. Both were bleeding, and in the heat the blood smell was so strong that Newt almost gagged. Then it stopped. Everyone expected to see the bull down, but the bull wasn't down. Neither was the bear. They broke apart, circling one another in the dust. Everyone prepared to pour bullets into the bear if he should charge their way, but the bear didn't charge. He snarled at the bull, and the bull answered with a slobbery bellow. The bull turned back toward the herd, then stopped and faced the bear. The bear rose on his hind legs again, still snarling. One side was soaked with blood. To the men, the bear seemed to tower over them, although 50 yards away. In a minute, he dropped back on all fours, roared once more at the bull, and then disappeared into the brush along the creek. Captain, can we go after him? Soupy Jones said, clutching his rifle.
Go after him on what?
Augustus asked.
Have you gone daft, Soupy? You want to chase a grizzly bear on foot after what you've seen? He wouldn't even make one good bite for that bear.
The bear had crossed the stream and was ambling along lazily across the open plain. Despite Augustus's cautions, as soon as the men could catch their horses, five of them, including Dish Bogette, Soupy, Bert, and the Irishman, and Needle Nelson, raced after the bear, still visible, though a mile or more away. They began to fire long before they were in range, and the bear loped toward the mountains. An hour later, the men returned, their horses run down, but with no bear trophies.
We hit him, but he was faster than we thought, Soupy explained. He got in some trees up toward the hills.
We'll get the next one, Bert predicted.
Hell, if he was in the trees, you should have gone in and tapped him with your old pistol butt, Augustus said. That probably would have tamed him.
Well, the horses wouldn't go in them trees, Soupy explained.
I didn't want to either, Alan O'Brien admitted. If we had gone in them trees, we might not have come out.
The mules had run 3 miles before stopping, but because the plain was fairly smooth, the wagon was undamaged. The same could not be said for Lippy, who had bounced so hard at one point that he had bitten his tongue nearly in two. The tongue bled for hours, little streams of blood spilling over his long lip. The remuda was eventually rounded up, as well as the cattle. When the Texas bull calmed down enough so that it was possible to approach him, his wounds seemed so extensive that Call at first considered shooting him. He had only one eye, the other having been raked out, and the skin had been ripped off his neck and hung like a blanket over one shoulder. There was a deep gash in his flank and a claw wound running almost the whole length of his back. One horn had been broken off at the skull, as if with a sledgehammer, yet the bull still pawed the earth and bellowed when the cowboys rode too close.
"It seems pity to shoot him," Augustus said. "He fought a draw with a grizzly. Not many critters can say that."
"They can't walk to Montana with half his skin hanging off his shoulders," Call pointed out. "Flies will get on that wound, and he'll die anyway." Pocampo walked to within 50 feet of the bull and looked at him. "I can sew him up," he said. "He might live. Somebody catch him for me."
"Yes, rope him, Dish," Augustus said. "It's your job. You're our top hand."
Dish had to do it or be embarrassed by his failure for the rest of the trip. His horse didn't want to go near the bull, and he missed 2 throws from nervousness and expected to be killed himself if he did catch the animal. But he finally got a rope over the bull's head and slowed him until 4 more ropes could be thrown over him. Even then, it was all they could do to throw the bull, and it took Pocampo over 2 hours to sew the huge flap of skin back in place. When it was necessary to turn the bull from one side to another, it took virtually the whole crew, plus 5 horses and ropes, to keep him from getting up again. Then, when the bull did roll, he nearly rolled on Needle Nelson, who hated him anyway and didn't approve of all the doctoring. When the bull nearly rolled on him, Needle retreated to the wagon and refused to come near him again. "I was rooting for the bear," he said. "A bull like that is going to get somebody sooner or later, and it might be me." The next day, the bull was so sore he could barely hobble. Call feared the doctoring had been in vain. The bull fell so far behind the herd that they decided to leave him. He fell several miles behind in the course of the day. Call kept looking back, expecting to see buzzards in the sky. If the bull finally dropped, they would feast. But he saw no buzzards, and a week after the fight, the bull was in the herd again. No one had seen him return, but one morning he was there. He had only 1 horn and 1 eye, and Pocampo's sewing job was somewhat uneven, the folds of skin having separated in 2 or 3 places, but the bull was ornery as ever. Bellowing at the cowboys when they came too close, he resumed his habit of keeping well to the front of the herd. His wounds only made him more irascible. The hands gave him a wide berth. As a result of the battle, night herding became even more unpopular. Where there was one grizzly bear, there could be others. The men who had been worrying constantly about Indians began to worry about bears. Those who had chased the wounded bear horseback could not stop talking about how fast he had moved. Though he had only seemed to be loping along, he had easily run off and left them. "There ain't a horse in this outfit that bear couldn't catch, if he wanted to," Dish contended. The observation worried Jasper Fant so much that he lost his appetite and his ability to sleep. He lay awake in his blankets for 3 nights, clutching his gun, and when he couldn't avoid night herding, he felt such anxiety that he usually threw up whatever he ate. He would have quit the outfit, but that would only mean crossing hundreds of miles of bear-infested prairie alone, a prospect he couldn't face. He decided that if he ever got to a town where there was a railroad, he would take a train, no matter where it was going. P.I., too, found the prospect of bears disturbing. "If we strike any more, let's all shoot at once," he suggested to the men repeatedly. "I guess if enough of us hit one, it'd fall," he always added. But no one seemed convinced, and no one bothered to reply.
Chapter 92.
When Sally and Betsy asked her questions about her past, Lorena was perplexed. They were just girls. She couldn't tell them the truth. They both idolized her and made much of her adventure in crossing the prairies. Betsy had a lively curiosity and could ask about 100 questions an hour. Sally was more reserved and often chided her sister for prying into Lorena's affairs. "She don't have to tell you about her whole life," Sally would protest. "Maybe she can't remember. I can only remember back to when I was 3.
"What happened when you was 3? Lorena asked.
"That old turkey pecked me," Sally said. "A wolf got him, and I'm glad." Clara overheard part of the conversation. "I'm getting some more turkeys pretty soon," she said. "Lori's so good with the poultry, I think we might raise a few." The poultry chores had been assigned to Lorena, mainly just feeding the 25 or 30 hens and gathering the eggs. At first it seemed that such a small household couldn't possibly need so many eggs, and yet they absorbed them effortlessly. July Johnson was a big egg eater, and Clara, who had a ferocious sweet tooth, used them in the cake she was always making. She made so many cakes that everyone got tired of them except her. "I've got to have sweets, at least," Clara said, eating a piece of cake before she went to bed, or again while she was cooking breakfast. "Sweets make up for a lot." It didn't seem to Lorena that Clara had that much that needed making up for. She mostly did what she pleased, and what she pleased usually had to do with horses. Housework didn't interest her, and washing in particular didn't interest her. That became Lorena's job, too. Though the girls helped her, they asked questions all the time they worked, and Lorena just gave them whatever answers came into her head. Few of them were true answers. She didn't know if the answers fooled them. The girls were smart. Sometimes she knew she didn't fool them.
"Are you going to marry that man?" Betsy asked one day.
"He's already got white hair."
"That's no reason not to marry him," Sally said.
"It is, too," Betsy insisted. "If he's got white hair, he could die any time." Lorena found that she didn't think about Gus all that much. She was glad she had stayed at Clara's. For almost the first time in her life, she had a decent bed and a clean room and tasteful meals and people around who were kind to her. She liked having the whole room to herself, alone. Of course, she had had a room in Lonesome Dove, but it hadn't been the same. Men could come into that room. Letting them in was the condition of having it. But she didn't have to let anyone into her room at Clara's house, though often she did let Betsy, who suffered from nightmares, into it. One night, Betsy stumbled in, crying. Clara was out of the house, taking one of the strange walks she liked to take. Lorena was surprised and offered to go find Clara, but Betsy wasn't listening. She had come into the bed like a small animal and snuggled into Lorena's arms. Lorena let her stay the night, and from then on, when Betsy had a nightmare, she came to Lorena's room, and Lorena soothed her. Only now and then did she miss Gus, though then she missed him with a painful ache and felt almost desperate to see him. At such times she felt cowardly for not having gone with him, though, of course, he himself had urged her to stay. She didn't miss the rest of it at all, the cowboys watching her and thinking things about her, the hot tent, the unpredictable storms, and the fleas and mosquitoes that were always there. She didn't miss the fear, either. The fear that someday Gus would be off somewhere and Blue Duck would come back. What had happened had been bad enough, but she knew if he ever got her again, it would be worse. Fearing him and missing Gus were mixed together, for Gus was the only person who could protect her from him. Unlike the girls, Clara seldom asked her any questions. Lorena came to wish that she would. For a while, she had an urge to apologize to Clara for not having always been able to be a lady. It seemed to her a miracle that she had been allowed to stay in Clara's house and be one of the family. She looked for it to go bad in some way, but it didn't go bad. The only thing that changed was that Clara spent more and more time with the horses, and less time in the house. "You came at a good time," she said one day as Lorena was coming in from feeding the hens. It was a task Lorena enjoyed. She liked the way the hens chirped and complained. "How's that?" Lorena asked. "I nagged Bob to build this house, and I don't really care about a house," Clara said. "We needed it for the girls, but that wasn't why I built it. I just wanted to nag him into it, and I did. The main reason was he wouldn't let me work with the horses, although I'm better with him than he ever was. But he didn't think it fitting. So I thought, all right then, Bob, build me a house. But I'd rather be down with the horses, and now there's nothing to stop me." 2 weeks later, Bob died in the night. Clara went in the morning to change him and found him dead. He looked exactly as he had. He was just no longer breathing. He weighed so little by then that she could lift him. Having long concluded that he would die, she had had Cholo bring a pine coffin from town. He had brought it in at night and hidden it from the girls. It was ready. Clara closed Bob's eyes and sat with her memories for an hour. The girls were downstairs now, pestering Lorena and eating. Now and then she could hear their laughter. They were happy girls. They laughed often. It pleased Clara to hear them. She wondered if Bob could hear his two lively daughters laughing as he lay dying. She wondered if it helped, if it made up in any way for her bad tempers and the deaths of the three boys. He had counted so on those boys. They would be his help. Bob had never talked much, but one thing he did talk about was how much they would get done once the boys got big enough to do their part of the work. Often, just hearing him describe the fences they would build, or the barns, or the cattle they would buy, Clara felt out of sorts. It made her feel very distant from Bob that he saw their boys mainly as hired hands that he wouldn't have to pay. He sees them different, she thought. For her part, she just liked to have them there. She liked to look at them as they sat around the table, liked to watch them swimming and frolicking in the river, liked to sit by them sometimes when they slept, listening to them breathe. Yet they had died, and both she and Bob lost what they loved. Bob, his dreams of future work with his sons, she, the immediate pleasure of having sons to look at, to touch, to scold and tease and kiss. It struck her that endings were never as you would expect them to be. She had thought she would be relieved when Bob finally died. She hadn't felt he was a part of their life anymore, and yet now that he was gone, she knew he had been, a silent part, an uncomfortable part. But still there, still her husband, still the girl's father. He had been changed, but not removed. Now he had gone where her boys had gone. As well as she knew the boys, as much as she loved them, time had robbed her of them. At times she found herself mixing details and events up, not in big ways, but in small. In dreams she saw her son's faces, and when she awoke could not remember which son she had dreamed about. She wondered if she would dream of Bob, and what she would remember if she thought of him in 10 years. Their marriage had had few high spots. She had often been happy during it, but not because of anything Bob did. She had had more happiness from horses than from her husband, though he had been a decent husband, better than most women had, from what she could judge. She didn't cry, but merely felt a wish. Now he was gone, that she could somehow escape dealing with the tiresome formalities of death. Someone would have to go for a preacher. There would have to be some kind of funeral. They had no close neighbors, but the two or three closest would still feel they had to come, bring food, and pay their respects. She covered Bob with a clean sheet and went downstairs. Lorena was teaching the girls to play cards. They were playing poker for buttons. Clara stood in the shadows, wishing she didn't have to interrupt their fun. Why interrupt it for a death that couldn't be helped? And yet death was not something you could ignore. It had its weight. It was a dead man lying upstairs, not a man who was sick. It seemed to her that she had better not form the practice of ignoring death. If she tried it, death would find a way to answer back. It would take another of her loved ones to remind her to respect it. So she walked into the room. Betsy had just won a hand. She whooped, for she loved to beat her sister. She was a beautiful child with curls that would drive men mad some day. "I won the pot, Ma," she said. And then she saw by the grave set of Clara's face that something was wrong. "Good," Clara said. "A good card player is just what this family needs. Now I have to tell you something sad. Your father's dead." "Oh, he ain't," Sally said. "Honey, he died just now," Clara said. Sally ran to her, but Betsy turned to Lorena, who was nearer. Lorena was surprised, but she put her arms around the child. "Could you go get July?" Clara asked Lorena, when the girls had calmed a bit. July now lived in a little room attached to the saddle shed. It wouldn't do when winter came, but for summer it was all right. He had never felt comfortable in the house with Clara and the girls, and since Lorena had come, he felt even more uncomfortable. Lorena seldom spoke to him, and Clara mainly discussed horses or other ranch problems, yet he felt nervous in their company. Day to day, he felt it was wrong to have taken the job with Clara. Sometimes he felt a strong longing to be back in his old job in Fort Smith, even if Roscoe was no longer alive to be his deputy. But he had a son now, a baby he saw every day at supper and breakfast. His son was the darling of the ranch. The women and girls passed Martin around as if he belonged to them all. Lorena had developed a rapport with him and took the main responsibility for him when Clara was off with the horses. The baby was happy, and no wonder, with two women and two girls to spoil him. July could hardly imagine what the women would do if he tried to take the baby and raise him in Arkansas. Anyway, such a plan was not feasible. So he stayed on and did his work, nearly truly content nor bitterly discontented. He still dreamed of Elmira and felt an aching sadness when he thought about her. Despite that ache, the thing that made July least comfortable of all was that he knew he was in love with Clara. The feeling had started even before he knew Elmira was dead, and it grew even when he knew he ought to be grieving for Elmira. He felt guilty about it. He felt hopeless about it, but it was true. At night he thought of her, and imagined her in her room, in her gown. At breakfast and supper he watched her, whenever he thought he could do so without her noticing. He had many opportunities, too, for she seemed to have ceased taking any notice of him at all. He had the sense that she had become disappointed in him, though he didn't know why. And when she did look at him, it frightened him. Occasionally, when he caught Clara looking at him, he almost flinched, for he did not imagine that he could hide anything from her. She was too smart. He had the sense that she could figure out anything. Her eyes were mysterious to him. Often she seemed to be amused by him, at other times irritated. Sometimes her eyes seemed to pierce him, as if she had decided to read his thoughts as she would read a book. And then, in a moment, she would lift her head and ignore him, as if he were a book that she had glanced through and found too uninteresting for further perusal. And she was married. Her husband lay sick above their heads, which made his love seem all the more hopeless. But it didn't stop the longing he felt for. In his daydreams, he fell to reinventing the past, imagining that he had married Clara instead of Elmira. He gave himself a very different marriage. Clara would sit in the loft with her feet dangling all day. She wouldn't have run off on a whiskey boat. Probably she wouldn't have cared that Jake Spoon shot Benny. He imagined them raising horses and children together. Of course, they had begun to do just that, raise horses and children together, but the reality was far different from the daydream. They weren't together. He could not go into her room at night and talk to her. He knew that if he could, he probably wouldn't be able to think of much to say, or if he did and said something stupid, Clara would answer sharply. Still, he longed for it and lay awake at night in his little shed thinking of her. He was doing that when Lorena came to tell him Bob was dead. Hearing the footsteps, he had hoped that it was Clara, and he pictured her face in his mind, not stern and impersonal, as it often was when she was directing some work, but soft and smiling, as it might be if she were playing with Martin at the dinner table. He opened the door and saw to his surprise that it was Lorena. "He died," Lorena said. "Who?" July asked absently. "Her husband," Lorena said. "Then she's free," July thought. He couldn't feel sad. "Well, I guess it's for the best," he said. The man wasn't getting no better. Lorena noticed that he sounded happier than she had heard him sound since she had arrived at the ranch. She knew exactly what it meant. She had often seen him looking at Clara with helpless love in his eyes. She herself didn't care one way or the other about July Johnson, but the dumb quality of his love annoyed her. Many men had looked at her that way, and she was not flattered by it. They wanted to pretend, such men, that they were different, that she was different, and that what might happen between them would be different than it would ever be. They wanted to pretend that they wanted pretty dresses and smiles, when what they really wanted was for her to lay down under them. That was the real wish beneath all the pretty wishes men had. And when she was under them, they could look down and pretend something pretty was happening. But she would look up and only see a dumb face above her, strained, dishonest, and anything but pretty. "She wants you to bring the coffin," she said to July, watching him. Let Clara worry about the man. Watching him only made her long for Gus. He gave things that no one else could give. He wasn't dumb, and he didn't pretend that he wanted smiles when he wanted a poke. They put the coffin in the front room, and July carried the frail corpse downstairs and put him in the coffin. Then, on Clara's instructions, he rode off to inform the few neighbors and to find a preacher. Clara and Lorena and the girls sat with the body all night, while Cholo dug a grave on the ridge above the barn where the boys were buried. Betsy slept most of the night in Lorena's arms. Clara thought it nice that she had taken to the young woman so. At dawn, Clara went out and took Cholo some coffee. He had finished digging and was sitting on the mound of earth that would soon cover Bob. Walking toward the ridge in the early sunlight, Clara had the momentary sense that they were all watching her, the boys and Bob. The vision lasted a second. It was Cholo who was watching her. It was windy, and the grass waved over the graves of her three boys. Four now, she felt. In memory, Bob seemed like a boy to her also. He had a boyish innocence and kept it to the end. Despite the strains of work and marriage in a rough place, it often irritated her, that innocence of his. She had felt it to be laziness. It left her alone to do the thinking, which she resented. Yet she had loved it, too. He had never been a knowing man in the way that Gus was knowing, or even Jake Spoon. When she decided to marry Bob, Jake, who was a hothead, grew red in the face and proceeded to throw a fit. It had disturbed him terribly that she had chosen someone he thought was dumb. Gus had been better behaved, if no less puzzled. She remembered how it pleased her to thwart them, to make them realize that her measure was different from theirs. "I'll always know where he is," she told Gus. It was the only explanation she ever offered. Now, indeed, she would know where he was. Cholo was watching her to see if she was hurt. He loved Clara completely and tried in small ways to make life easier for her, although he had concluded long before that she wasn't seeking ease. Often in the morning, when she came down to the lot, she would be somber and would stand by the fence for an hour, not saying a word to anyone. Other times there would be something working in her that scared the horses. He thought of Clara as like the clouds. Sometimes the small black ones would pour out of the north. They seemed to roll over and over as they swept across the sky, like tumbleweeds. On some mornings, things rolled inside Clara and made her tense and snappish. She could do nothing with the horses on days like that. They became as she was, and Cholo would try gently to persuade her that it was not a good day to do the work. Other days, her spirit was quiet and calm, and the horses felt that too. Those were the days they made progress in training them. Clara had brought two cups. She was very glad to be out of the house. She poured Cholo his coffee and then poured some for herself. She sat down on the mound of dirt beside him and looked into the open grave. "Sometimes it seems like grave digging is all we do," she said. "But that's wrong. I guess if we lived in a big town, it wouldn't seem that way. I guess in New York there are so many people you don't notice the dying so much. People come faster than they go. Out here it shows more when people go, especially when it's your people." "Mr. Bob, he didn't know mares," Cholo said, remembering that ignorance had been his downfall. "Nope," Clara said. "He didn't know mares." They sat quietly for a while, drinking coffee. Watching Clara, Cholo felt sad. He did not believe she had ever been happy. Always her eyes seemed to be looking for something that wasn't there. She might look pleased for a time, watching her daughters or watching some young horse, but then the rolling would start inside her again. The pleased look would give way to one that was sad. "What do you think happens when you die?" she asked, surprising him. Cholo shrugged. He had seen much death, but had not thought much about it. Time enough to think about it when it happened. "Not too much," he said. "You're just dead." "Maybe it ain't as big a change as we think," Clara said. "Maybe you just stay around near where you lived, near your family, or wherever you was happiest. Only you're just a spirit, and you don't have the troubles the living have." A minute later, she shook her head and stood up. "I guess that's silly," she said, and started back to the house. That afternoon, July came back with a minister. The two nearest neighbors came, German families. Clara had seen more of the men than of the women. The men would come to buy horses and stay for a meal. She almost regretted having notified them. Why should they interrupt their work just to see Bob put in the ground? They sang two hymns, the Germans singing loudly in poor English. Mrs. Jinch, the wife of one of the German farmers, weighed over 300 pounds. The girls had a hard time not staring at her. The buggy she rode in tilted far to one side under her weight. The minister was invited to stay the night and got rather drunk after supper. He was known to drink too much when he got the chance. His name was Reverend Spineau, and he had a large purple birthmark under one ear. A widower, he was easily excited by the presence of women. He was writing a book on prophecy and rattled on about it as they all sat in the living room. Soon both Clara and Lorena felt like choking him. "Will you be thinking of moving into town now, Mrs. Allen?" the Reverend asked hopefully. It was worth the inconvenience of a funeral way out in the country to sit with two women for a while. "No, we'll be staying right here," Clara said. July and Cholo carried out the mattress Bob had died on. It needed a good airing. Betsy cried a long time that night, and Lorena went up to be with her. It was better than listening to a minister go on about prophecy. The baby was colicky, and Clara rocked him while the minister drank. July came in and asked if there was anything else she needed him to do. "No," Clara said. But July sat down anyway. He felt he should offer to rock his son, but knew the baby would just cry louder if he took him away from Clara. The minister finally fell asleep on the sofa, and then, to their surprise, rolled off on the floor and began to snore loudly. "Do you want me to carry him out?" July asked, hoping to feel useful. "He could sleep in the wagon just as well." "Let him lie," Clara said, thinking it had been an odd day. "I doubt it's the first time he slept on a floor. And anyway, he isn't your lookout." She knew July was in love with her and was irritated that he was so awkward about it. He was as innocent as Bob, but she didn't feel moved to patience in July's case. She would save her patience for his son, who slept at her breast, whimpering now and then. Soon she got up with the baby and went to her room, leaving July sitting silently in a chair while the drunken minister snored on the floor. Once upstairs, she called Sally. Sally had not cried much. When she came into Clara's room, she looked drawn. Almost immediately, she began to sob. Clara put the baby down and held her daughter. "Oh, I'm so bad," Sally said when she could talk. "I wanted Daddy to die. I didn't like it that he just lay up there with his eyes open. It was like he was a spook. Only now I wish he hadn't died." "Hush," Clara said. "You ain't bad. I wanted him to die, too." "And now you wish he hadn't, Ma?" Sally asked. "I wish he had been more careful around horses, is what I wish," Clara said.
Chapter 93.
As the herd and the Hat Creek outfit slowly rode into Montana out of the barren Wyoming plain, it seemed to all of them that they were leaving behind not only heat and drought, but ugliness and danger, too. Instead of being chalky and covered with tough sage, the rolling plains were covered with tall grass and a sprinkling of yellow flowers. The roll of the plains got longer. The heat shimmers that they had looked through all summer gave way to cool air, crisp in the mornings and cold at night. They rode for days beside the Bighorn Mountains, whose peaks were sometimes hidden in cloud. The coolness of the air seemed to improve the men's eyesight. They fell to speculating about how many miles they could see. The plain stretched north before them. They saw plenty of game, mainly deer and antelope. Once they saw a large herd of elk and twice small groups of buffalo. They saw no more bears, but bears were seldom far from their thoughts. The cowboys had lived for months under the great bowl of the sky. And yet the Montana skies seemed deeper than the skies of Texas or Nebraska. Their depth and blueness robbed even the sun of its harsh force. It seemed smaller. In the vastness, and the whole sky no longer turned white at noon as it had in the lower plains. Always somewhere to the north there was a swath of blueness, with white clouds floating in it like petals in a pond. Call had scarcely spoken since the death of Dietz. But the beauty of the high prairies, the abundance of game, the coolness of the mornings finally raised his spirits. It was plain that Jake Spoon, who had been wrong about most things, had been right about Montana. It was a cattleman's paradise, and they were the only cattlemen in it. The grassy plains seemed limitless, stretching north.
It was strange that they had seen no Indians, though. Often he mentioned this.